Thank you, Loret. I'm going to speak about laminar turbulent interfaces today, and you can find them in many flows, for example, jets entering a surrounding quiescent fluid, also in wall-bounded shear flows. And here I'm going to talk about pipe flow, as you can see, and the reason for that, if you compare them to other wall-bounded shear flows, we choose pipe because pipe is naturally periodic in this azimuthal direction. Furthermore, the spanwise or azimuthal direction is short. It's of the order of the radius, which means in comparison, for example, to channel flow, there's hope that we can model such a system in a quasi or in a one-dimensional way. Whereas surely, if we want to speak about turbulent laminar interfaces in channel flow, we'll have to think about taking two directions into account in the modeling. The system is also extended in this direction. And if we want to go to boundary layers, or some other colleagues do, we have the added difficulty that the flow will be developing in the axial direction. So we think it's a good starting point to look at pipe flow and try to see what one can do with one-dimensional modeling. And if I start about pipe flow, I go back just briefly to Reynolds, but for non-experts. So we know that, and Reynolds knew this already, that the flow is laminar and can be kept laminar if you are careful enough. So it's linearly stable. And then later, if you disturb it, for example, the water in the tank of your experiments is unsettled, you will see, or you have an obstacle at the entrance of the pipe, you will see these laminar turbulent patterns, and you see here these interfaces, and these are those that we are interested in the physics and also in the modeling. Now we can go 90 years forward. These are the experiments of Ignansky and Champagne, who use different types of obstacles at the inlet and observed also how these patterns develop. And here we have two different situations. The one I'll be mostly focusing today into is this one here. So we have at low Reynolds number this spatiotemporal intermittency, and that's something which is intrinsic to the flow. So if you have an obstacle or you put a localized disturbance, then the flow will evolve into such a pattern. And we can see that's quite interesting. In the upstream side, we have these very sharp fronts. Then we have sort of diffuse fronts on the downstream side. And here, the next turbulent patch, and then a smooth or gradual decay towards laminar flow. If you look at this pattern several diameters after, or hundreds or thousands of diameters after, it will look still very similar. Whereas in this other case, at 4,200 Reynolds number, if you look at this pattern a few diameters farther in your pipe, these two fronts, so this laminar part, will have disappeared and will end up just with one turbulent structure. Yeah, so this sort of intermittence is not intrinsic to the flow. If you wait long enough, this will get filled by turbulence. That's why also Bignansky and co-authors realized, and 2 years later, they decided to do similar experiments, but now instead of using obstacles, they introduced a localized disturbance in space and time. And that's good because then you generate a single patch and you can monitor the dynamics as you go downstream along the pipe. Now, a couple of years later, here I took the signals from the paper of Nishi in Erlangen because they are quite nice and clean. And you can see these dynamics. I talk about spatiotemporal intermittency, so paths, path sequences. This would be related to the critical Reynolds number in pipe flow, also to directed percolation. I'm not going to talk about this today. Today we'll be focusing more on these two patterns down here. And that's at larger Reynolds number. So this continuously expanding turbulence will not have laminar gaps in between. And if we look now at the fronts, which is the particular focus of the talk, you see that this back edge, or what I will call upstream front, it's always very sharp. Sharp here, sharp here, sharp here. And if you look at the different Reynolds number, it has essentially not changed. So it's nearly the same everywhere. If you look now instead at the downstream edge, or here at the front edge, you will see a low Reynolds number, this gradual decay from turbulent to laminar. Not very sharp front, same here, but if you go to larger Reynolds number, you will see that the front is very sharp, and you can compare it, you can compare this downstream front to the upstream one, and they look, actually the structure looks symmetric on the two sides. And that what this distinction, changing from this rather gradual transition from turbulent to laminar to this sudden transition is what we'll look at today. And we'll do so by direct numerical simulations using Agilis code, what would be the precursor of OpenPipeFlow. And here you can see a snapshot from a simulation. So we have a structured 2600 Reynolds number. We expect it to grow. And you can look at the upstream and downstream interfaces, and you can see some of the features we saw from the signal of velocity from the experiment. So a sharp front at the upstream side, then a downstream front, which is more or less diffuse. So we have the vortices are here more intense toward the bulk, and then they are gradually dropping in intensity. And if we look at lower Reynolds number, the structure would be shorter, but essentially these two fronts would be unchanged. And if we look a little bit at the dynamics, we can see that in both fronts, more or less here, vortices are generated at the interface and they are traveling towards the bulk of the structure. So in the downstream direction, and if you look at the downstream front, you'll see that the vortices come from the bulk and more or less, in average, they are propagating out of the structure. So you see sort of a continuous laminarization towards Poiseuille flow. Now, if we go up to large Reynolds number, where we expect that the fronts will be rather similar, so we can see it here in the snapshot quite well, that sharp front and sharp front here. There are some differences in the radial dependence, but that these are details. Now, if you look into the flow, you'll see a big difference at the downstream edge. Now, the turbulence is not propagating into laminar flow and dying there, but rather turbulence is getting advected towards the bulk. And that, as we'll see later, is a key feature distinguishing the two types of structures. Now that's the turbulence of the structure, how the vortices look inside. The easiest thing, the one you would first measure if you look at laminar turbulent interface, is the speed at which they propagate. And that's what people had done in the past. And this was the status in 2010, I think, when we sat down with Dwight Barclay and Bjornhof in Barcelona to speak about this, and Dwight had some ideas how to model it. So you can see data from different experiments and also some simulations by Johan Duguay, Ashley Willis, and Rich Kurzweil. And it's difficult to make out a trend or a pattern. So for the upstream front, the sharp front, the trend is quite clear. The velocity, the speed of the interface decreases as a function of the Reynolds number. Whereas if you look at the downstream front, so here it's nearly the same speed. Structure is localized, doesn't grow. And then at some point, the two data sets, they detach. And we have that the downstream front is propagating faster than the mean speed of the pipe. Yeah? Sure. Does this count to my 30 minutes, or?
No, that's supposed to be counted separately. Okay. Sorry about that. Okay. I'm Nigel Goldenfeld, University of Illinois.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is it very clear from the data that the fronts move linearly in time, or is there any possibility that there could be some power law or something like that? Is it crystal clear?
So the fronts move; they are turbulent. So, but in average, they move quite linearly.
Mm. Yeah.
So we have done average over different windows, and they are moving linearly with some fluctuation on top.
Okay,
that's the evidence we have so far.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, and that's so we decided, and then we spent quite a few million hours in the clusters, and then Bjorn's pipe was running in the lab quite extensively, and that's that we collected from DNS and simulations, and you can see DNS data here in these red triangles. The experiments in blue, and this all looks, they fit quite well together. Also, you can see that the curve has quite interesting, nice features, so it's not any curve that simple scaling that you may have expected a priori. And even the nicest thing is that this line here is the model proposed by Dwight Barclay and captures, as you can see, the speeds in a very wide range of Reynolds numbers. And here, if we think about these different types of fronts we can see, we have seen in the downstream side, the weak ones, the rather gradual smooth transition from turbulent to lamina would be down here, and then we have an inflection point. And when you go towards the higher Reynolds number, we have this sharp front also on the downstream side. And Dwight's model could explain this all very well, very neat. So this is published here. I recommend, we are here in extended program, so especially for postdocs and PhD students who want to get up to date with the problem of pipe flow, especially the modeling and theoretical side, to read this perspective paper from JFM. I think there's a, spend one day on it. I think it's really worth. Here we'll just touch on some of the things that are more relevant to my talk. Important points, we have two variables. So we start Navier-Stokes, we have three velocities, components, one pressure. Here we just have the streamwise velocity at the center of the pipe. So that's just one variable at one point in space. And then we have the turbulent intensity, which could correspond to the transverse fluctuations. So we have two variables instead of four or three, once we eliminate continuity. And then we have just one spatial direction. And that's a very important point, as I said at the beginning. We just have dependence on the streamwise direction. And if you look at the model, so it's from the left-hand side, it's pretty easy. We look at the center line velocity, it's just a convection equation. Then we have a coupling term between the center line velocity and the turbulent intensity. And this just means that the turbulent, if we have more turbulence in the flow, the center line velocity will decrease. We have a more blunted profile. That is captured, among other things, by this term. And now we have also the equation for the turbulence intensity. And if we look at the advection part, and that's quite important, we see here that the turbulent intensity gets advected at a different speed than the center line velocity. And that's a key point which was not present in the original model by Dwight in 2011, and turns out to be essential for the interface business I'm talking about today. And then we have also a coupling term and a diffusion term. So what does the model say or predict? The model predicts the following. We have here this upstream interface, which is always stable. You can see it here because it's solid. And then we have two different types of interfaces on the downstream side. So this is front speed, that's in the previous diagram. We have the weak one, this gradual laminarization, or the strong one. And if you take an asymptotic limit, so the interface thickness goes to zero, this epsilon here, then they coexist in some range. A large Reynolds number, we have a strong interface. At low Reynolds number, we have a weak interface. If you don't take this interface thickness to be zero, but to be some finite value, like in reality for turbulence, then you end up with a smooth transition between the two types of interfaces. And that's, I will say a couple of words more about this. So the model captures very well reality, here shown as for pipe flow in purple and for duct flow, which is also 1D, so that's a square duct. Model captures both behaviors very well with this nice inflection point as the Reynolds number increases, and the corresponding localized weak and strong fronts. Now let's see what are the predictions of the model? What is the physics behind this change between weak and strong interface? How does the turbulence act behind these phenomenological changes we see in the model, in the 1D model? And to do this, what we'll do is we'll look at our DNS. We'll take our structure. So here I'm showing Q, which could be the transversal velocity or the turbulence intensity in Dwight's model. And I'm going to split the structures we look at, because they are growing. I'm going to split them in three parts. So an upstream front, I'll take a cutoff on Q and set the point here, then go some distance to the left and to the right. I will define this as the upstream front. I'll do the same for the upstream, for the downstream front, and then the rest will be the bulk. And the bulk is turbulent flow with the mean properties as in Blasius' law, so with the friction as in Blasius' law. Now, let's do a first comparison in more detail between model and DNS, and you have this here. So if you look at the front structure in the UQ space, so center line velocity and turbulence intensity, let's first start with the model and with a simple path. Here you have a signal, a pressure signal from, Q signal, so transversal velocity from the experiment. So you start here, 2 would be velocity of lamina flow, turbulent intensity 0, you are far away from the structure here. Then you come toward the structure, turbulence intensity start rising, the profile becomes more blunted, so the streamwise, the center line velocity drops. And then the loop closes and we go back to lamina flow from this side. And this you can see that from the DNS you get exactly this type of behavior. Now we are going to increase the Reynolds number to the weak slack regime. So here, for example, 2600, that's the first movie I showed. And now you can see also the same behavior as we approach the interface, turbulence intensity increases, centerline velocity decreases, then we go to the bulk properties of turbulence. And then from here, we have just a decay toward lamina flow. And that's exactly what you'll see here. So once you are in the bulk, you decay back to the lamina flow. Now, if you take a large Reynolds number, in our case, for example, 5,500, what you see from the DNS instead is that you go to the bulk value of turbulence, and then you have an overshoot, so the turbulence intensity increases and becomes larger at the downstream front. And that's exactly also what the model is showing here. Now, these are the model. It just contains the average properties of the flow. But of course, we are speaking about a very turbulent situation. So these peaks are oscillating a lot. Turbulence production can increase, decrease in time. So let's have a look now at these fluctuation properties. And interestingly, I want to look at what happens in the intermediate regime. Because in the model asymptotic case, we have either weak or strong fronts. What happens in reality if we go somewhere in between? What you'll see here from this spatiotemporal diagram, so the upstream front is always strong here down. And if you look at the downstream side, you will see that depending on time, you'll have weak fronts. So you see rather diffuse or strong fronts here in red. And if you can measure the velocities of these temporarily, so just in these regions, and put them here, you'll see that they fall exactly where the, or very close to where the asymptotics predict. Yeah, so these two values that you get from the asymptotic from the model can be observed also transiently in the DNS. And what you can see is that the DNS actually, in this transitional or in this intermediate regime, you display one type or other front depending on time. Yeah, so we observe this front switches very often. So now I would like to look at the turbulence, what happens with turbulence at the interfaces. Yeah, how is turbulence generated? Why is this front strong and this weak? What is the distinction between them? And to look at this, I'll have a look at the turbulent kinetic energy equation. Yeah, so we define here the kinetic energy, that's the fluctuating velocity once we have removed the temporal mean. The equation looks like this. So we have a convective derivative here for a turbulent kinetic, mean convective derivative for the turbulent kinetic energy. Then we have some flux terms. All they do is just to redistribute turbulence intensity across our domain. And then we have two terms here. One is the production and the dissipation. And there is a source, essentially, and this here is a sink for the kinetic energy. Now, of course, if we're looking at the bulk properties of turbulent pipe flow, we can apply this equation as it is. But our fronts are moving, and we want to focus on the fronts. So what we'll do is to do the analysis moving with the front. Yeah. Then the time derivative will just drop because we assume that our fronts are in a statistically steady state, and we are really are, this we have checked. And then what we end up with is a production term, which will be positive, and then we have dissipation, and then terms that the convective derivative that redistributes or moves kinetic energy from one part of your domain to another one, and then the flux terms would do the same. So looking at this now, we try to understand what are the differences between the different interfaces. And I will start with a low Reynolds number, 2600. So we are here to the left. That's lamina flow. And as we approach, so we can have the video here, as we approach the structure, then turbulence production begins to increase until it reaches a peak. And then it drops towards the throws the bulk value, and that's what we expected. At the upstream interface, we always have a peak in turbulence intensity, and we have so also a peak in turbulence productions. By the way, these equations are integrated also in the radial and azimuthal direction so that we just get streamwise dependence. Now, what happens with the dissipation? If we look at the dissipation, we see so that this zero means where the peak of production is, and we see that dissipation is displaced to the right. And what this means is that turbulence is produced at some point here in the streamwise direction, and it's then convected. We can see here the convective part, convected farther downstream where it gets dissipated. So essentially, for this type of interface, we have strong production close to laminar flow. We are extracting energy from the laminar flow, and then this energy goes towards the bulk and gets dissipated there. Yeah, so all these curves have to add to zero, and this delay, we can see this delay between production and dissipation is explained by convection toward the bulk. And here the convection has a positive contribution because we are dissipating this energy that came from the bulk. Now, interestingly, if we look at the downstream side, so this rather diffuse interface at this low Reynolds number, what we see is that we are just at a constant level of production and dissipation with no fluxes. Fluxes are zero in the bulk. That's exactly what we expect. In the bulk, turbulence is homogeneous with respect to the streamwise direction. And then what happens as we go over the front, turbulence is just decreasing in intensity. And it does so, and that I think is interesting, in a way that we are nearly in local equilibrium. So we have like a decaying front, but locally in equilibrium. There's not much transport in the streamwise direction. We are just like a homogeneously decaying turbulence in a tunnel. And more importantly, I think I pointed this before, is the advection that we saw that plays an important role in Dwight's model. And here we can see, I think, quite clear that all these vortices, or most of the vortices, are transported and they are decaying, as we see here. So production is decaying along the interface. And we have a small advection in the downstream direction. Now, if we go to the kinetic energy budget at large Reynolds number, this interface has not changed, so there's no point to comment it. But if we look at the downstream side, we see that the downstream side is becoming like the upstream side, but mirror reflected, which is exactly also a prediction of the model. That in the high Reynolds number limit, we should expect the upstream and downstream interface to be symmetric. And this we can see very well here. So we have the same issue with the prediction, with the production, delayed dissipation, and then convection, which is transporting the turbulent kinetic energy towards the bulk. Yeah, so behind. And we can see here the role, thank you, played by advection. Again, we have a very sharp front as we expected, and we can see this production of turbulence, how we produce our turbulence here at the interface, and we transport it toward the bulk. So the question is what determines, or what is the key for switching between these two types of front, weak and strong, as we increase the Reynolds number? And we saw that in Dwight's model, the key parameter for this is the mean advection speed, which is different for turbulence intensity and centerline velocity. So we decided to look at that, and there are several ways we could do this. We could reduce symmetry to compute the speed of the turbulent flow. We didn't do this because it was just easier to estimate it with this formula, which essentially corresponds to take your pattern and the pattern shifted after some delta t and minimizing the difference by choosing the axial shift. And you can see more information about this method in this paper here. So we decided to compute this turbulence advection speed, and that's what we did this in a fully turbulent pipe, so without interfaces, because that's a bulk property of turbulence. And we can see here nicely, it drops. So there is the advection velocity drops with Reynolds number. And what we found also quite interesting is that there's a constant difference between the centerline speed and the turbulent advection speed. So if you subtract them, you just get a constant. And that's actually an assumption of Dwight's model. We're quite surprised to see that that's indeed the case. Now, You have seen we have these switches of fronts, so we can do is quantify if we see more one type of front or the other type of front as a function of Reynolds number. And we did this and compare it to the effect of the convection velocity. And this is what I see here. So that would be the speed of the downstream front. And we find indeed that the crossover from having more weak fronts here to having more strong fronts corresponds more or less to the point where the advection speed of turbulence crosses the actual speed of the front. Yeah? So if the front can move faster than the mean turbulent advection speed, then it will be able to extract energy from the laminar flow, will have a net production and a strong front, whereas if the turbulent advection speed is faster than the front, then the turbulence will just go and die in front of the front, which is what we have seen in the movies. Yeah? And just to show that this meets also with other criteria, so this would be the crossover at 2900, what we can do is also look at the height of this peak at the fronts of the structures and the peak turbulent intensity in the bulk. And what you can see is that at about Reynolds number here, 3000, we also have a crossover. So before, we had higher turbulent intensities at low Reynolds number in the bulk than in the front. And as we increase the Reynolds number, we change to the peak appearing into the downstream edge. So this criteria fits similarly, and then the data go quickly to to quantities that do not depend on Reynolds, and maybe at larger Reynolds number, actually the downstream front becomes identical to the upstream front. But this is just speculation. Now, I have only 1 minute or two, or I don't know, nothing left. So I have 3 minutes, and I would like to to make a small change of topic, because we are here to talk about exact coherent solutions. We talked about modeling the fronts with these two-dimensional, this one-dimensional advection reaction diffusion model with two variables. What about exact coherent solutions? Well, exact coherent solutions exist that are localized in space, and we have shown that they generate chaos, transient chaos, and then later spatiotemporal chaos as the Reynolds number increases. So I think that these structures may be a good starting point to look at the fronts and see if they can, by using ideas of these exact coherent solutions, we can understand the dynamics and the physics of the fronts of real turbulent structures. So we start looking at these solutions. Here we have solutions for different symmetry subspaces, M2 and M3. And then in the right-hand side, what I have is this is the streamwise direction, and that's the infinity norm of the streamwise velocity. This may be familiar from a talk today morning from Roman Grigoriev. And we can see in pipe flow also that the interface, or the velocity, the magnitude of the solution drops exponentially in the streamwise direction. If you look at the details, you will see that different velocity components may drop at slightly different rates, which makes the modeling a bit more difficult than, for example, in plane quiet flow. Also, of course, the fronts depend on the type of symmetry of the structure. If you look at the dependence on Reynolds number, you'll have something which is a bit surprising. So the downstream front is not changing slope much, whereas the upstream front changes a lot. It becomes flatter as you increase the Reynolds number, but in all cases it is exponential, which means maybe we can model it using linearization, as was done first by John Gibson and then followed by others. And indeed, in pipe flow, it turns out that also this linearized model captures very well the drops of the tails of these structures. And more importantly, as in the other problems, the speed at which the structures propagate dictates the slope at which the solutions decay spatially. And this is seen to be the case here as well. So here you have the ANSARD that is used. So it's essentially linear stability analysis in the spatial downstream direction instead of in time, as usually. Now, these are the predictions for the fronts. So they are essentially axis symmetric in the downstream side, and they have this non-axis symmetric nature than in the upstream side. they fit. So if you look at the model, except some cases I'm not going to discuss here in detail, that's the azimuthal velocity, model can predict very well what you see in the tails of the exact coherent structures, which is good. And furthermore, and that will be my one before last slide, if you take a turbulent slug or a turbulent path and you look at the decay of the streamwise velocity in the streamwise direction, you will see it also, which is that is exponential. And actually, if you fit the slopes and look at the speed, you will see that this linearization is working well also for the case of a real turbulent structure. Here you can see profiles from the VNS of such a strong slug, as I have shown before, and the results from the linearized model. That's just work that is being right now, so it's not finalized. We hope to finish it in the next weeks here at KITP. That's what this program is for, hopefully. Now, here I am at the end. So I think it was a nice idea to look at pipe flow to understand laminar turbulent interfaces. It's certainly much easier than in other wall-bounded shear flows, maybe more difficult than in a jet. This we could speak about later. So the modeling can be done, and that is what Dwight accomplished. And this model captures many things that were known about the interfaces, but it has given also predictions that later we have actually verified very closely by DNS. So it's, I think, really amazing how a 1D model can capture so well the dynamics of interfaces which are highly three-dimensional and highly complicated. That's something I have not shown here, but here we did a Lagrangian analysis of these interfaces, and they are really complex. And their dynamics is dictated also by the Kolmogorov scale. So that's pretty difficult dynamics explained all by a one-dimensional model. Now, the distinction between fronts is this relaminarization at near local equilibrium, so like in a homogeneously decaying turbulence in the streamwise direction. And this production, strong production of turbulence, which actually it will happen depending if the front is able to move faster than the turbulent structures or not. And now I stop talking. Thank you.
Yeah, so one question, well, very, very nice talk. Adrian Stanford. So the model that you're using is a 1D model that, well, it is the Burgess equation, invested Burgess equation plus a forcing.
Well, it's a Burgess equation for the, or similar to the Burgess equation for the center line speed, right? But but we have two equations
for the center line speed. That we know that will generate a discontinuous front. And there is no pressure in that equation. Well, my question is if you see thing that what is happening here, then the pressure is not playing any role, because in that model, unless I don't know what is that G.
If you look at the production equation, actually this flux term T contains transport by pressure fluctuations.
But this is, you apply to
DNS. As you can see here, it's really, in one interface it's negligible, and the other it's quite small.
Because that is the total kinetic energy, and the pressure doesn't play any role. But if you go one component by one, like the three velocities separated, is known that the pressure will redistribute the energy from the U to the V, from the V to the W. It will do that. So, well, what I mean,
that's what you would conclude if you look at the equations. But then here we don't see that pressure is necessary to capture.
So it seems to imply that it's not important to this this front.
So it will be surely important if we want to speak about the three-dimensional structure of the front, I think, but not for this.
Nigel Goldenfeld, University of Illinois. Could you say something about why the fronts are so sharp?
I mean, I can give you a circular argument, right? But it's answering why. I think it's really when the front is able, and I don't know why, is able to travel faster than the turbulent structures, then it's not surprising that it's sharp.
I mean, because naively one might say, well, if you have diffusion of turbulent kinetic energy, so you're going to get some sort of tail or something like this, and the fronts clearly are much sharper than
the diffusion is very, very small. I mean, I cannot give you a physical answer motivated, but
Okay. Maybe we can talk after.
Yeah, maybe we can talk afterwards.
Steve Tobias, Leeds. You have your 1D model with some parameters in there, and then you compare it with the full DNS. So can you just say a little bit about how you calculate the parameters in this model, and do they change as you change the Reynolds number, and how do they change?
So in the we can see then later and look at together the appendix of this paper.
Okay.
But this it's done in it's not that we put like 3-4 parameters and they get all fitted by some algorithm. So the parameters can be determined in steps. For example, this diffusion parameter sets the opening of this parabola. That's something, how fast this parabola opens, it's something that the model cannot predict by itself. But this, we adjust D just by fitting this DNS data with a parabola. So taking the upper branch strong and this one. And then the one which is a bit, so the epsilon of the front thickness drops in the asymptotic case, you don't have it. In the non-asymptotic case, it tells you how fast this inflection point is. There's a later fit to the data because this curve is independent from the others. But I think the key point is that all these, the qualitative features of the model, so weak and strong fronts, this subcriticality here, how this front emerges, these inflection points, these are all independent of the parameters. So there's not much freedom that you really have to, the functional shapes are given independent of the parameters you use for the model.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Wes from USPCI. Can you explain once why the velocity, the C velocity of the front minus the central line velocity is constant?
I mean, I have no clue why it is so. Because this speed here, see, it captures the speed of vortices and strict structures of all sizes. Whereas the other one is just the center line of the mean velocity profile. I don't know why they should be a constant. This was a surprise to us. I don't know if anybody has an argument for this, but it just turns out to be so. Sorry to give such poor explanations to your questions, but these are things that we have not really thought in detail. I think they're quite hard, actually, the questions. Yeah.
Would you be willing to speculate what happens at a Reynolds number of 10 to the 5?
Bruno Eckhart from
the one thing Harvard. Is that nobody will be able to verify it experimentally, probably, right, Bjorn? We could. Well, we can ask the guy who developed the model. Now, I don't really see how the physics or why the physics should change as the Reynolds number increase. So I think as the fronts will keep moving faster. But there's maybe one thing which I think won't be correct here, and that's that if you take this parabola from the model, it means at some point you would hit negative velocities for the upstream edge, and I think this won't be true. But of course, there is nobody tells that this approximation of the model, so this will be a parabola to first order, say only in the low Reynolds number. I couldn't expect to see changes, but there may be. Do you have a suggestion, or maybe Dwight? You want to bet? We can. So I think it will remain so, but that's just my opinion.
More questions? No? Well, I think actually we have a break even just after this one talk, am I right? Yes. Okay, so we can discuss further on the break. Thank you.
Thank you.